This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Now, Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome. It's Wednesday, time to talk about your health. And just when we thought we are getting a break from pandemics, viruses, whatever, bird flu is back on our radar. And it's not here in Canada, at least not yet, but it has appeared in a number of U.S. states, and it's been discovered in dairy cattle. So should we be taking precautions? And medical authorities in the U.S., including the American College of Cardiology and the American College of Chest Physicians, have introduced updated guidelines for atrial fibrillation, a condition that is very common in older people. And back here at home, the new dental care program is supposed to start next month, but it appears that very few dentists have signed on. So the numbers to call: 416-360-0740, toll free 1-866-740-4740.
Now, time for The Medical Record.
And now I'd like to welcome Dr. Malcolm Moore, medical oncologist and former head of the BC Cancer Agency, Dr. Fahad Razak, Canada Research Chair in Data Informed Healthcare Improvement. That's quite a mouthful, at the University of Toronto, and Dr. Elisa Naiman, family physician and founder and medical director of the Medical Station in Toronto. Hello, everyone. Thanks so much.
Hi, Libby. I need to shorten my title.
Yeah. And that's only one of them. So let's begin with the bird flu. Should we be worried about it here? Should we be doing anything preventive? Fahad.
Yes. Unfortunately, it is something we have to be worried about in the sense of it reflecting a broader issue which we are facing, which is the spillover of animal viruses into humans. Obviously, we just went through a horrific 4 years with COVID, and you know there are theories about lab leaks and other things, but still the dominant scientific consensus around this right now is that it is most likely an animal-to-human event. And it would follow a long history of animal-to-human events, including SARS-1, including MERS. And in fact, the WHO has had 7 of these emergency declarations in the last 20 years. So these are events that we think are going to unfortunately accelerate as humans and animals live closer together, as you have more animals in farms. And specifically, what we're worried about here is that the avian version of this virus, which was predominantly in birds, which we saw, I'm sure your listeners have been aware of, these mass die-offs of wild birds in the last couple of years. There's clear evidence now it's leaped from birds to mammals, specifically now dairy cows. And anytime the virus shows that ability to transfer from one species or type of animal into another type of animal, it's developing that kind of mutation capacity that we worry about. So as of today, is there a direct worry for humans? No. Do I think this represents a broader issue of concern? It absolutely does. And most of us feel like if it's not this event, it'll be another event in the near future where we do see another jump that extends all the way into humans and causes problems.
Okay. But Dr. Moore, does that mean we have to worry about eating beef from the United States, certainly from the states where this has been found? I've read about people deciding not to eat runny eggs. What about those things?
Okay, so I don't eat meat, so I don't think that, you know, there's good health reasons not to do that. But I think in terms of getting the bird flu from eating meat. I don't think that, honestly, I defer to Fahad as the expert, but I don't think that's a risk. I think he gave a very good answer, basically, that a lot of the pandemics have really come from some animal-to-human transmission of a virus that doesn't ordinarily move between animals and humans. And, you know, there's a ton of animal diseases, distemper, et cetera, that, for reasons we're not totally clear on, stay in animals and don't move to humans. But it seems like over time what we've discovered is that you can get mutations in these viruses that then make them transmittable. So I think, honestly, the only precaution at this point is if there's a diseased bird, a bird dies on your property, just be very careful about handling something like that. And I think that's a reasonable precaution to take.
If I could, Libby, if it's helpful, I can just add that there's, you know, this has been a question asked around food safety. There is no specific concern around food safety. In general, cook your eggs well, cook your beef well, because not avian influenza, but a major source of people getting sick is undercooked animal products, which carry a whole range of bacteria and viruses. So, but specifically for avian influenza, nothing has changed.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, runny eggs are great. I eat runny eggs all the time.
Yeah.
Elisa, are your patients worried about this?
Nobody has come in worried about avian flu. People come in still about measles, although that seems to have slowed down a little bit in the last couple of weeks. But nobody yet has come. But it's a good point that I think we're going to see more and more of viruses spreading from one species to the next, and then it puts us at risk. I think in the dairy cows, I think people need to make sure that they're just drinking pasteurized milk. I know there's this underground of people buying unpasteurized milk directly from farmers, which is technically illegal, and really people should be not purchasing unpasteurized milk. And I think that this now exposure
and cheese. Unpasteurized cheese is also a thing.
Yep. But people will go directly and farmers will bring it into the city and people will buy unpasteurized milk because they think that pasteurization is not healthy and that you should be exposed to these viruses, so you build immunity, and people just prefer to do that. But this is just another example of the importance of having correct food safety, and people should be buying pasteurized milk.
Yeah, people believe all kinds of things, especially about food. Last question on this avian flu thing, Dr. Moore. So you said don't handle birds. I mean, how many people do handle birds? And I even saw like the craziest headline said people really should stop kissing birds. I don't think it was a joke.
Yeah, so I mean, I think I'm not sure that kissing birds is that common. It's not something I've been ever leaning towards doing. But I think that, you know, probably the most common is that you're on your property or on your driveway and there's a dead bird, which is always distressing. And I just think, you know, given that could have died from an avian flu, the most important thing is just be very careful in handling that.
Okay, moving right along
protect
here.
Your pets, Libby. I would add, you know, a practical tip would be protect your pets. So, you know, if you have, for example, a dog and it's in the backyard and there's a dead bird, remove that bird and keep it away from your dog. Or if you're taking it for a walk, like these are the practical things. I think as Malcolm pointed out, it's, you know, the direct handling for humans, you know, that's kind of uncommon. But your pets could go after one of these dead birds, and that's where there's an opportunity to be vigilant.
That's a really good point. Okay, moving along to atrial fibrillation. It's something that's really common in older people, and there are some new American guidelines. Dr. Naiman, I'm assuming that you have quite a few patients with that problem.
That's right. As people age, they become more at risk for developing atrial fibrillation, often due to structural changes that happen to your heart as you age, such as from hypertension, lung disease, and so that it makes people at risk for developing atrial fibrillation, which is an irregular heart rate, which is usually a fast heart rate. And it's quite interesting that some people will be able to pick up and that they are in atrial fibrillation. It's usually at the beginning, it will be that it comes and goes, and it's quite distressing to people because they will feel this rapid heart rate. And then for now, how it's usually managed is the first line is that it's usually managed by going on medications that are used to control your heart rate. But there's these new guidelines that take a broader approach and actually quite interesting are working on prevention of developing it as you age.
Okay. Who wants to explain the new guidelines? Fahad?
Sure. Yeah. So atrial fibrillation, incredibly important entity. So it's the most common kind of heart arrhythmia or irregular heartbeat is what arrhythmia means. And it affects probably 10% of people over the age of 65. So probably very relevant to Zoomers in general. And the lifetime risk is about 30%. And the reason we care about AFib so much is that it is a major risk factor for strokes. So when your heart starts to beat irregularly, the blood is not pumped as efficiently out of the heart, and part of it can start to pool within the heart, and that's where clots can form. And then those clots can be thrown off and they can go to the brain, which is what a stroke is. The importance of these new guidelines is recognizing a staged approach. This, again, is a very common arrhythmia. And so they're talking really about upstream prevention. So looking at major factors such as obesity, physical activity levels, smoking, alcohol consumption, uncontrolled blood pressure. These are all very controllable risk factors. And I would say the major risk factors for atrial fibrillation. So these new guidelines are arguing that recognizing these factors early, intervening before they reach the point where you have atrial fibrillation is important. Once you have atrial fibrillation, there's a lot of new evidence about alternate therapies for medication, such as what we call ablation therapy, where the part of your heart that's triggering the irregular heartbeat can be addressed directly rather than being on medication for the rest of your life. And finally, something of popular interest is the relationship between coffee and atrial fibrillation. Mm-hmm, we've thought for a long time that coffee consumption was a major issue. These guidelines are reassuring in the sense of saying that coffee is probably not as important as we historically thought about with atrial fibrillation. So kind of reassuring people that, reasonable coffee consumption is something that they can continue.
And atrial fibrillation is an irregular heartbeat, Dr. Moore, but is there a difference between getting a rapid heartbeat that's regular, tachycardia, and atrial fibrillation, or is it two sides of the same coin?
So the way they taught us in medical school about atrial fibrillation, which is very common, is that it's irregularly irregular. So some people have a regular rapid heartbeat, something called PAT, paroxysmal atrial tachycardia, where your heart rate goes up to, let's say, 150, 180, but it's regular. The thing with atrial fibrillation is because it's a problem with conduction through the heart is that it will be irregular. So it won't be like a metronome, but it'll be sort of rapid, then a bit slower, then more rapid. And, the real danger of that, and people flip in and out, and the real danger, of course, is the blood clots, which can form when the heart isn't beating properly. And then when the heart starts beating properly, the blood clot can be discharged.
Right, but is there a difference from in preventing or treating from the regular rapid heartbeat and the irregular one?
Well, I think there's something called atrial flutter, which is a regular rapid heartbeat, and you can vacillate between one and the other. But I think the fibrillation, the atrial fibrillation is the most common, and it is important also to make the distinction that this is very different. I mean, this condition is not life-threatening of itself. People may feel lightheaded. Ventricular fibrillation, where the ventricle, the muscle that's pumping most of the blood, if you get ventricular fibrillation, then that is lethal, and that's why we cardiovert people who have a cardiac arrest.
And what is SVT, Dr. Naiman?
Oh, it's SVT is another type of irregular heart rate that it depends on where the electrical conduction starts. And it's a ventricular type, but I'm sure that Dr. Razak, the internist, would be able to provide a better answer than me.
Okay, go ahead.
I'm going to give you a simple and hopefully not too boring answer, Libby, which is that, truthfully, there are hundreds of kinds of rapid heartbeat arrhythmia. So arrhythmia just in general means an irregular pattern of heartbeats. There's hundreds of different kinds which involve your heart going very, very fast. Some of them are normal heartbeat patterns, just going faster than you hope for. Those are called sinus tachycardias. And then there's a bunch like SVT that you just mentioned, where the point of origin that's driving the heart to go really fast is in different parts of the heart above the ventricle. Supra just means above the ventricle. The important thing I think for your listeners is that the diagnosis of what is causing a rapid heartbeat is actually pretty involved. And so if you do feel it, get assessed. Go in. It involves typically an ECG and then potentially a bit of prolonged monitoring. And most of these tachycardias or irregular heartbeats in general are very treatable. And they're treatable both in terms of reducing the irregular heartbeat itself, either through medication or other approaches, but also by reducing the risk of the complications like stroke. And this is where we use things like blood thinners or other therapies to reduce the complications. So the way we handle this in medicine is we make a diagnosis about the specific kind of arrhythmia, and then we start either the preventative therapy or the management of risk.
Okay, I'm going to give the numbers out again. I would assume that a lot of people listening have questions about AFib. 416-360-0740, toll-free 1-866-740-4740. If you have questions about AFib or any of the other things that we're talking about here with our medical record panel. And just to wrap things up, ablation is one of the treatments for it. Who wants to describe what that is?
I'm happy to take the internist lead if that's helpful.
Okay, sure.
I can just say that historically, the way that we managed these irregular heartbeats, atrial fibrillation, is we put people on medication, which would reduce the tendency of the heart to contract, slow it down. That's how we would reduce these irregular heart rate patterns like atrial fibrillation. There was then emerging science to suggest that the area of the heart that was responsible for triggering these irregular heartbeats, that you could cauterize it by going through with a catheter. And by cauterizing it, you could prevent it from triggering the abnormal heartbeats. This was tested now in a bunch of randomized trials. And for specific patients, it's a safer approach to eliminating the atrial fibrillation. Once the procedure is done, you may never need to take medication again. But it's not for everybody. It falls into specific categories. So for example, if you have irregular heartbeats like atrial fibrillation and you also have heart failure, we now know that this approach, ablation, is better than putting you on medication.
Interesting. Okay. And you were mentioning alcohol as a possible factor. And in some countries, and there seems to be an increasing move to put warning labels on alcohol. Dr. Moore, what do you think of that?
I'm not a huge, I mean, I know in smoking, you know, we do it, and who knows how effective that's been in the reduction of smoking. I think people who drink are aware of the risks and the potential for risks, and drinking is so ubiquitous, if you like. So I'm not sure that putting warnings on them, it smacks of the appearance of doing something about it as opposed to actually doing something about it.
Dr. Naiman, I mean, yes, people have always been aware of the risks of excessive drinking, but now I keep reading things that any amount of drinking is dangerous and it causes cancer, and we need to warn people about it.
That's right. You're 100% right. So safe drinking guidelines are for women, not more than 7 drinks in 1 week, and for men, not more than 14 in a week, and not more for both genders, not more than 2 at one time. And when you go over that with people, people look at you with just such disappointment, especially women. And, you know, a couple of years ago, there was a large cohort study that came out that basically said that there's no safe amount that you can drink. It's a carcinogen, and there's no health benefit. Prior to this, we always used to say, you know, oh, go have a glass of red wine. It's good for your heart. But really now the recommendation that I make to people is that you really should be limiting the amount that you drink, and that there really is no safe amount to drink. It can be associated with liver cancer. It can cause cirrhosis of your liver. And people need to be aware that this sort of does need to be on par with smoking. And if there is warnings that are on cigarettes, then perhaps people should be aware of that there is a risk and realize that there really is no safe amount. And then when you talk to people, people just say, you can't take this away from me. There's nothing else. I'll do everything else, but I really want to have my tequila every night. And so we try to work on risk modification and at least drinking the least amount that they can drink. But a lot of people do drink a lot, and people should be aware that there really is no safe amount to drink.
Well, yeah, but not every medical person I talk to accepts that there is no safe amount to drink. What's your view of that, Fahad?
I think, okay, so we're, you know, what I worry about in this, and so my first feeling is that the data is, we're talking about levels of risk for those who are moderate consumers. So again, it's not the alcohol, it's the pattern of consumption. It's very clear that episodic heavier drinking, high amounts of chronic drinking, that these are associated with harms. But when you get down to the very small amounts, a half glass of wine with dinner, you know, a few days a week, honestly, as someone who has my very long and wordy title in your introduction highlighted, I'm someone who looks at data and health outcomes, the data is just not clear. And I don't think we're going to have crystal clear evidence. And honestly, the reason why that's the case, part of it is because even if there's risk at an individual level, the risk is so incredibly small. And we have to acknowledge that a lot of what we do in society are things that are important to enjoyment of life. And part of that would be moderate consumption of alcohol with dinner or with a meal is part of one of the real pleasures of life for many people. And even if there is theoretically an incredibly small risk, I think we have to think about kind of first order problems we worry about, second and third order. And this strikes me as a pretty low risk to talk about. There are bigger things. You know, we had 4 years of an absolute crisis that we've just come through. We've had air pollution days because of wildfires. These are the bigger risks to me. And so what I would say to people is problematic drinking, which is binge drinking, heavier chronic consumption, the risk is so clear. And we see it on the medical side all the time. It's not just atrial fibrillation. It's cancers. It's a leading cause of death among young men. That is very clear. Very moderate consumption as part of a lifestyle, as part of social activity. My honest feeling as someone who is not a specialist in the area but cares about data is that the data showing risk for that group is very murky. And, you know, it's part of moderate consumption or part of what you consider to be enjoying your life. I think those are reasons where those are areas where I think it's very hard for us medically to step in and say, no, there's risk.
And you're talking about tiny risk. I've never seen it sort of quantified. It's just like this, no amount of drinking is safe.
Yeah, and this is where I think this kind of shift to looking at the very edge of the prediction of these equations that we're using, you know, we're looking at hundreds of thousands of people and trying to tease out, even among those who are consuming very small amounts, if there's risk, it's really murky at that point. And I would say, look, there was a time where we would think, a famous phrase in medicine was the French paradox, where there was lower rates of heart disease in France, and we know that the food was rich, and one of the leading theories was it was their red wine consumption. I think we've moved to the point where it's very hard for us to say that alcohol is beneficial. That was historically what we thought, that small amounts, especially red wine, were beneficial. I think I would never, as a physician, now say that you should start drinking because there's benefit. It's just that if someone said, look, I have a glass of wine with dinner occasionally a few times a week, is that safe? I would say, look, there's nothing that I can tell you to say it's unsafe. It's important to you. If you enjoy it, I would say you should continue to do it.
I just saw a story in the New York Times. It's like, why are older people drinking so much, Dr. Moore? I mean, is that because their habits or our habits were established before all of this came out?
Okay, that's a pretty complicated question, and but I would like to kind of reiterate what Fihad said, is that I think my worry with some of these new alcohol guidelines is, look, I've had friends who have problem drinking. I know what problem drinking looks like. Problem drinking is not drinking a glass of wine with a meal on occasion. And I think some of the new guidelines, particularly the Canadian guidelines, basically, as interpreted, would say that 80 to 85% of the population has a drinking problem. And I think in some ways it minimizes the consequences of the really severe alcohol problems that we have in our society. And I might make the analogy of driving, right? Like, driving has a risk associated with it. It's small. If you drive when you're drunk, if you drive excessively fast, if you drive while you're texting, then driving becomes dangerous. But we don't conclude from that that nobody should drive because there is a small risk. It's just that you should drive appropriately. And I would say the same thing with drinking. There is a line, and when you cross that line, then you've got a problem. And that's when the health risks occur. You don't get cirrhosis from drinking a couple of drinks a week. You get cirrhosis from drinking excessive amounts every day. And I think that's where our focus needs to be.
Okay. On that note, we wrap things up. Thank you so much, Dr. Malcolm Moore, Dr. Fahad Razak, and Dr. Alisa Naiman. Thanks again. Bye-bye.
Great to be with you. Thanks, Libby.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Okay, we are taking a break. And when we come back, we continue our focus on health. And we're going to talk about vaccines against pneumonia and why it's important to get those on board.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. We continue our focus on health today. And as the old saying goes, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. Are you protected against pneumonia, a disease that can be very serious, even deadly, in older people? And there are vaccines which can protect you. So do you have questions about this? The numbers to call, 416-360-0740, toll free 1-866-740-4740. And I am now joined by Dr. Jia Hu, a family physician from Calgary, who's also an expert in health policy, public health, and preventive medicine. Dr. Jia Hu, thank you so much for joining us. Hi.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Okay, so first of all, what are the kinds of vaccines that are available and who should be taking them?
Yeah, so I think it's maybe worth clarifying. The word pneumonia itself is kind of a generic term for sort of an infection of the lung. But, you know, I think there's a specific type of bacteria, or pneumococcal bacteria, sorry, the words get complicated, that causes not just lung infection, but also things like meningitis and sepsis. And so it can be very severe. And, you know, right now we have, broadly speaking, two vaccines available. We have a conjugate vaccine that sort of is a bit better at sort of evoking an immune response, and a polysaccharide one that's a bit older. But, you know, it is recommended in people, pretty everybody 65 and older, actually, and many who are younger. But our uptake rates are very low in Canada.
And now, in the past, I have to say I've had both of those vaccines. I had pneumonia, and but there's you have to take one before the other, or I don't remember the rule about it, but there is one, right?
Yes, there was a rule around one before the other. I mean, I think that's changing now, especially as new conjugate vaccines come online. Some of these newer sort of, and the conjugate ones, the one that's a bit more, you know, protective, I'll say. And they've evolved a bit because they're covering more and more strains. And as a result, we're just saying maybe just take one of these conjugate vaccines to make things a little bit easier for the patient. One other thing to note is that, you know, many things cause pneumonia. A flu, influenza causes pneumonia. You know, common colds can even cause pneumonia, and this is protecting against a specific type of bacteria that causes really bad pneumonia.
Okay, I want to let's talk about pneumonia and the risks of it, because and especially related to the flu, because I think a lot of people still think of the flu as something that is fairly mild. And you can get pneumonia, as you said, after the flu. But the especially for older people, the consequences of that can be really terrible. Like up to, it can cause death, and it causes several thousand every year. But also, it can debilitate people to the point that they can no longer live independently.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And you're spot on about sort of the pneumonia caused by influenza, or really any pneumonia that lands you in the hospital. I mean, every year, you know, tens of thousands of Canadians will be admitted to hospital for pneumonia. Those tend to be people who are 50 and indeed 65 and older. And even if you sort of, you know, get the pneumonia under control, it does really increase one's frailty. So one's ability to sort of go back into the way they were living before. Maybe you were living independently before, but maybe after you have the pneumonia, you need a bit of help at home, or maybe you need to move into a nursing home. That's another, you know, I'm glad you pointed out, less known consequence of these types of infections. They can really take away your independence.
And do you see a lot of that in your own practice?
Yeah, I mean, my practice does tend to be focused a bit more on younger adults. But certainly, I think that when I do see an older adult, I always want to encourage them to get all the vaccines that are recommended to them. Because anytime somebody, let's say, who's 70, 65, 80, goes to the hospital, you know, they don't, even again, you know, of course, dying is a possibility. But a lot of the times, you know, you read the discharge summaries and, you know, you say, we need more care. So then you end up arranging home care, or you end up arranging long-term care. And if we can prevent those in the first place by getting these pneumonia vaccines or these flu vaccines, all the better, I think.
What are the names of the vaccines, and why do you think the uptake is so low?
Yeah, so in the sort of pneumonia world, there's a conjugate pneumonia vaccine and a polysaccharide pneumonia vaccine. And more the conjugate pneumonia vaccines, which are basically essentially beginning to take over. And I think one of the brand names for the conjugate is called Prevnar, and the polysaccharide is called Pneumovax. And they're taking over because, you know, they're just a lot more effective at actually preventing pneumonia. And some of the other things, right, which is more than just pneumonia, sepsis and meningitis, really bad stuff. You know, I think uptake is low for a number of reasons. You know, we generally think of vaccination as more important for kids than adults, even though there's so many new vaccines coming on for adults, certainly with COVID. You know, the COVID vaccine is arguably a lot more important for kids than adults, for adults and kids, I should say. You know, another is that a lot of these vaccines aren't publicly funded. Right. When we think of the measles vaccine, you know, think of it as free. We think of vaccines as being free. And one of the issues is right now, a lot of vaccines that even public health organizations are recommending aren't actually free. And so it's a combination, I think, of, you know, awareness of the vaccines and then access barriers. And I think that needs to change, especially as, you know, vaccines for pneumonia or flu or RSV, shingles as well, become more and more important for the older populations.
Well, we're talking to you in Calgary, which is Alberta, here in Ontario, and every province, excuse me, every province, of course, has their own regime of what they cover and what they don't. So right. Here in Ontario, they cover the vaccines for people who are 65 and over or at very high risk.
Yes, they cover the Pneumovax, the polysaccharide one, but they generally don't cover the conjugate one, the sort of better vaccine. And, you know, some of these new vaccines came online last year, like a newer version of the conjugate vaccine that covers, you know, 20 strains, and there's another one coming on that'll cover 21 strains of pneumonia. But they, generally speaking, you're totally right. It does sort of vary based on where you are in terms of what's covered. But coverage for that conjugate pneumonia vaccine tends to be quite limited across the country. And it is covered in a few people, I think, that are quite immunocompromised, but not in the general seniors population. Not yet, and it should be.
Well, I'm looking. Is Prevnar 13 the conjugate vaccine?
Yes, and they have a new one. It's called Prevnar 20, actually.
Oh, okay. So 13 is covered.
Yeah.
Yeah. Would you think that either not covering it or confusion about what's covering it is the barrier here, or is it just general awareness?
Oh, it's both, I think, right? I think that, you know, when we've sort of done surveys of Canadians, we see that, you know, a lot of people don't know. Even the term pneumonia, right? So many things can cause pneumonia, as you pointed out, like flu. Gets confusing, right? So what exactly is a pneumonia vaccine? So that's definitely a set of issues. I think another set of issues has to do with the coverage and the funding, right? I think a good example is, say, shingles. In Alberta, shingles vaccine isn't covered. In Ontario, it is covered. And that is, tends to create a bit of confusion in it. And then, I do think, you know, there's more and more of this sort of vaccine hesitancy or decreased confidence in vaccines that's been emerging since the pandemic that's going to erode coverage rates. But if we look at sort of the national levels, I think uptake of the pneumonia vaccine is about 55%, which is about 80%. You know, our targets are 80%, so it's quite a bit lower than that. And so all those things I mentioned are reasons for it being lower than where we want it to be.
You mentioned vaccine hesitancy, which has been it's been increasing. Can you tell me a little bit more about that, about what you encounter and how you counter it?
Yeah. So, I think certainly even before the pandemic, there was some vaccine hesitancy. You know, there were some linkages being made, false linkages, I should say, between the measles vaccine and autism. But during the pandemic, I think certainly I'll say misinformation ran wild and rampant, and probably a bit more in the province that I'm living in than the province that you're living in, but certainly all over the country. And, you know, we've done sort of public health folks have done surveys around the world. You know, I think a recent Angus Reid survey showed that something like, you know, 20-30% of parents would not, you know, would ask questions about vaccinating their kids, whereas before it was only 5-10%. And so I think it is sort of more and more common. I think, you know, that manifests in, you know, a number of different ways, right? A lot of people say, you know, for flu, for example, they might say, you know, like, why do I need to get this vaccine? Like, you know, it doesn't work, or, you know, the flu isn't really affecting me. And so there's sort of a host of, you know, things you might say about flu that are a bit different than COVID. I think to counter it, which is maybe the more important thing, I think one thing is for people to sort of, you know, understand about the consequences of the disease, right? I think for people to want to get vaccinated, they have to believe the disease to be protected against serious. I think it is important to, you know, empathize and listen to their concerns and to sort of address them head on, right? And I think it's important to sort of bring in as much sort of personal story and anecdote as possible, right? I think big numbers, and we tend to like numbers and statistics, you know, don't work as well as, you know, stories of people being affected by the disease or stories of, you know, effective prevention.
Okay, we have got to take another break. I'm going to give the numbers out again for people who may have questions about these very important vaccines. The numbers are 416-360-0740, toll-free 1-866-740-4740, and we will be right back with more on this.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to 1. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. I am talking about protecting yourself against pneumonia with Dr. Jia Hu. And the best way to do that is by getting vaccines. And some of the pneumonia vaccines are covered here in Ontario if you're 65 or over or at high risk. But the uptake is not what it should be. So I'd like to hear from you. Did you get your pneumonia vaccines? I did. And if not, why not? And do you have questions about them? The numbers to call, 416-360-0740, toll free 1-866-740-4740. And Dr. Hu, how long do these vaccines last? Is it one and done, or do you have to get revaccinated after a while?
You know, as far as we know, for the conjugate vaccines, it's a one and done. Basically, in the past, for the polysaccharide, we sometimes said maybe you get a booster in 5 years, but for the conjugate one, really, for now, it's just you get one, which makes it a lot easier.
It does make it a lot easier. Okay. And is it the same for the earlier versions of the conjugate vaccine?
For the PCV3. I mean, right now, you know, I think what NACI, the National Advisory Committee on Immunization, is recommending is that if you, you know, have had a PCV13, the Prevnar 13, as you've had, it's still worth getting the Prevnar 20. But another year, another vaccine called Prevnar 21 or PCV21, I should say, is also coming out. And so there's a lot of movement in this space. And so certainly I'd recommend everybody who's had a vaccine or not vaccine actually get the newest vaccine because it does offer a lot more protection.
Well, and when governments fund this, I mean, again, it's different in every province. Is it a separate kind of conversation or a separate process for them to approve an updated version, or do they have to go through, do they start from scratch, or is it almost automatic? Do you know?
No, they kind of start from scratch, actually. And so every time a new vaccine becomes available, they have to reconsider that vaccine by its own merits. Prevnar 13, I forgot when it's been out for more than 6 years, like 6 or 7 years, I think. And so when, you know, PCV20 or sort of the new pneumococcal vaccines of like 21 come out, they have to sort of consider them on a case-by-case basis. There isn't really any automatic coverage mechanism when it comes to vaccines, and that can lead to some delays in vaccines being funded compared to certain medications, unfortunately.
And do there have to be new clinical trials?
Oftentimes, it depends on the vaccine specifically. For some, you need more clinical trials. For the shingles vaccine, that was a new vaccine, that needed clinical trials. For some of the pneumococcal ones, sometimes you just need data showing that it protects you against these new strains. With the pneumococcal vaccines, basically the advancements tend to be, you know, initially with the conjugate vaccines, there was a PCV7, it only covered against 7 strains of pneumococcal bacteria. In reality, there's sort of dozens, actually, and so they made the 13, and then they made the 20, and they're going to make the 21, and the goal here really is to sort of cover as many circulating strains of the pneumococcal disease as possible, and when that happens, there tends to be only a need for, you know, immune data versus full-on clinical trials.
So you're saying there are dozens of these strains, right?
Yes, exactly.
And are the vaccine makers aware of all of them? Are there new strains that come out all the time?
They are aware of all the strains, and I wouldn't say there are new strains that come up so much as the sort of the strains that cause disease change over time. So, for example, you know, when the PCV13, the vaccine that you got, came out, and it came out in kids first, actually, right? So it's given as part of the routine immunization program to, you know, kids under 1 across the country and in Ontario. That sort of changed the makeup of the strains that circulated, because it would sort of cause some to go down and others to go up in proportion to what caused disease. And so as manufacturers started thinking about how to make the vaccine better, and they're like, oh, this strain is now causing a lot of disease, let's make sure that the latest vaccine covers this strain. And they've also been able to put in a lot more strains, right? Going from 7 to 13 to 20 to 21 are pretty significant increases in overall coverage.
Are you saying it's like a technical thing for getting so many strains in one vaccine? Or can you explain that a little more, please?
Yeah. It is a bit of, and this is sort of, you know, reaching the limits of my knowledge a little bit, but it is a technical thing, right? So, you know, I think what we've been able to do in recent years is actually put more strains in a vaccine. Because imagine every strain is kind of like its own little mini pneumonia in a way, right? And so you need the technology to put more strains to offer more protection without, you know, while ensuring that there's still enough stuff in there to evoke that immune response. And so that's what they've been doing. And, you know, one of the questions that, you know, people have raised is, you know, how many strains can you fundamentally put into a vaccine? And, you know, it seems we're doing, before you begin to lose effectiveness, it seems we're doing okay at the 20 mark. But, you know, this just speaks to sort of advancements in vaccine science where, you know, 20 years ago, we wouldn't be able to do that.
Okay, that's interesting. You know, one of the things that came out of COVID was the use of mRNA technology for other things.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So we talked a bit about vaccine hesitancy. And one of the things that I encounter here, just, you know, from audience members calling in, is not people who say, I don't believe in vaccines. They say, you know, 50 years ago when I was a small child, I had a bad reaction, so I'm allergic to them.
Right. So that's really interesting. And I mean, I guess furthering that conversation, do people often share what those allergies are?
Not really. They don't even know. They say I had a bad reaction or I'm allergic, and from the conversation it doesn't sound like there's any evidence for that.
Yeah. I mean, and this is an interesting, you know, case scenario you put in front of me, because, you know, I think on the one hand, you know, serious vaccine allergy is incredibly rare. It can happen, right? We know that anaphylaxis can happen, but it's kind of like one in a million rare. People can often have, you know, side effects from vaccines. That's extremely common, actually. You know, I think that if I had a patient, you know, say that to me, I think that I'd probably try to explore as best I could what their sort of reaction was and try to explain some of the risks of reactions post vaccines. There are ways of actually testing for vaccine allergies, right? I mean, it's a pretty niche thing and we don't have too much capacity to do that. But certainly for anybody who, you know, we thought had a major reaction, we could test against it. But by and by, people... It's not dissimilar, I think, to people who have sort of antibiotic allergies, right? A lot of the times they think they've got a really bad allergen, really just have a little rash. So I think that, again, when it comes to sort of how to speak to people and convince them to get vaccinated, you know, one thing really is to try to acknowledge their concern. So if they said it, for sure, I acknowledge you've had it. And then let's talk about, you know, what it might have been and how we can move forward.
And what are some of the common reactions to a vaccine that, you know, are not that worrisome?
Yeah, so I mean, and this holds true across almost all vaccines, actually. And so, and a lot of people remember this from their COVID vaccines, but things like, you know, some pain, redness, swelling at the site of the injection, a bit of a rash, feeling a bit crummy for a day or two, what we call a malaise. Those are you know, a bit of a headache, it's an upset stomach, those sort of symptoms. Those are what I call non-specific symptoms linked to, you know, vaccination that you can get from virtually any vaccine. There are sort of more specific, you know, for example, if you get an MMR vaccine, you can actually get a little measles-like rash sometimes. But, you know, the fact is, bad reactions, things like, for example, anaphylaxis, are just extremely rare. We wouldn't be able to give vaccines to millions of people if bad reactions were common, because then, you know, a lot of people would get them.
Mm-hmm. So what would you say the key is to educating people about the vaccines and the importance of getting them? I mean, why is it so hard for that message to get through?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the key really, I mean, you know, we've talked about vaccine hesitance, we've talked about sort of barriers to access like funding, but I do think the key issue is sort of the one around, you know, awareness of the disease and disease severity, right? So even when I use the word pneumonia, you know, I think people often think they have, you know, it evokes a lot of different things. I don't think they know there's specifically a pneumonia vaccine that's actually quite effective. You know, I think that, you know, if I use RSV as an example, right, I would say that 3 years ago, nobody really knew what RSV was, probably, right? It was only a couple of years ago when it was sort of part of the triple-demic that people kind of begun to be aware of RSV even as a disease state. And that sort of timed with the launch of the vaccine, which worked out pretty well. And so for most Canadians, most adults, they aren't going to be super vaccine hesitant, as you say. And so it's more just awareness of those conditions. I think we've done a decent job of making older Canadians aware of sort of shingles, right? And so I think about half Canadians have a shingles vaccine. But for things like pneumonia, you know, I think that the key really is to make people aware of the fact that a vaccine exists specifically for the condition, and that vaccine is very effective, and that, you know, the condition itself, you know, the pneumococcal bacteria, the different strains, can cause a lot of really bad things. And that's where you get your sort of, you know, you probably get 80% of the way there if everybody's sort of equally educated with respect to those things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What about people just being tired that, you know, when it comes to the COVID vaccine, they're saying, I've had enough vaccines. I don't want to get yet another booster. Do you think that the fact that people had to get, you know, most people I know have had probably five COVID vaccines. Are they just sick of getting vaccinated? And then there's the flu vaccine every season that hopefully prevents all of this.
Mm-hmm. Really good question. I think this sort of vaccine fatigue you point out is a real thing. I do think that COVID and is in a category of its own, right? Like, I think with COVID, many people have had five vaccines. Many people have had COVID. Flu also has some sort of challenges, right? I think with flu, you have to get it every year. Many people shouldn't get this. I think these are great vaccines to get. But with flu, I think a lot of people think they, you know, had the flu already, even though what they had is common cold, not the flu. I think people misunderstand what the flu is. I hope that with some of these other conditions, like RSV and pneumonia, shingles, which is quite distinct from the others, the fact that the vaccines are hopefully just given once, the fact that sort of these conditions are, you know, maybe perceived as more concerning and more serious than COVID, which we often are nowadays, can sort of help drive that. But you're right. I think if people view these new vaccines as similar to COVID vaccines, we'll be dead in the water. Nobody's going to get them. And so if our job to really differentiate those conditions a little bit to ensure that people know how serious they are, and you know the fact that we're not going to make you get a vaccine every year, which really can be quite tiresome.
And what's the role of family doctors in getting their patients to get these things? And how does the fact that there's a huge shortage of family doctors and it's hard to get in to see them, how does that impact it?
Well, that's a huge problem, right? I mean, I think that the main place people get their vaccines and information about vaccines is from their family doctor, right? You know, we do see public health obviously plays a role, and pharmacists are playing more and more of a role. But even this discussion that we just had, right, it's easiest to have with a family doctor. And so, you know, I think with the sort of crisis in primary care and in family medicine, probably a lot of preventative stuff sort of gets, you know, moved on the wayside. I mean, understandable that happens, right? Maybe, you know, if you don't have a family doctor, hard to have these conversations. If your family doctor is too busy, you might focus on some other things. And so, you know, vaccines, like anything else in healthcare, sort of don't exist in a vacuum. And, you know, we need to strengthen primary care in Ontario and Alberta everywhere so that, you know, that relationship and the ability to talk about vaccines still exists. I think in the meanwhile, you know, what we can hope for is, you know, public health step up a little bit. Pharmacies can do a lot of this counseling as well. But you really do need that. You know, I think it's quite critical to have a strong primary care system and for people to have their own family doctors. Otherwise, that is the main way people will get educated.
And I'm looking at the clock. We're just about out of time. Is there anything else that you would like to leave us with?
I mean, I would just say that, you know, as if you're listening to the show and you're adult, you know, vaccinations are important for you as well, for pneumonia, for other conditions, COVID, flu, shingles. There's a lot, actually. I mean, the good thing is that some of these vaccines, you only need once, as we talked about. And so, you know, if you do have the ability to talk to your family doctor, please do so. Talk to your pharmacist. But it's a really, really easy way to protect yourself against some pretty harmful diseases.
Okay. Dr. Jiahu, thank you so much. This was really very informative, and we appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Bye-bye. And that is all the time we have for today.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.